This is the Mad Women Podcast, brought to you by Embolden, champions of women in digital. We share stories from female leaders in mobile, digital, and marketing, connecting, inspiring, and emboldening thousands of women across North America and around the world. In today's show, our hosts Lara Mahana, president of Embolden, and Embolden CMO Rachel Pasqua speak with global leadership and innovation expert Val Wright. In their conversation, they discuss Val's trademark approach to helping executives and companies fast-track market domination, a methodology outlined in her first book, Thoughtfully Ruthless, and further illustrated in her latest book, Rapid Growth Done Right, Lead, Influence, and Innovate for Success. Enjoy the show. Val, thank you so much for joining us today. Lara and I both had the chance to read your new book this week, and we're so excited for you to share some of the incredibly smart thinking from it with the Embolden community.
It is great to be here. Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So, you know, your first book, which made such a big impression on me personally, Thoughtfully Ruthless, focused on strategies for accelerating one's personal career. Whereas the new book, Rapid Growth, explores how to enable that same kind of upward trajectory at the company level. And you talk about ensuring that technical and creative and business teams within an organization have not only shared purpose, but a common language, something you call the innovation trifecta.
What I found is when I work with executive teams and in companies, there are often moments where people look puzzled. And they might be sat in a board meeting, or they might be sat in a leadership team meeting, and you get this curious or confused look on people's faces. And it's because the technology leader might be explaining something, and maybe the head of marketing or a creative leader doesn't quite understand. And I describe it as, it's kind of like you've landed in Japan and you're trying to talk French. And when you're not understood in a foreign country, you often talk slower and louder and hope that somebody understands you. And that kind of creates a lost in translation moment. And so what I realized is that happens, you know, with a creative, a technical or a business mind. There's often this lost in translation, and that extends to, you know, how relationships are built, how companies are organized, how decisions are made. And so I call this the innovation trifecta, because it's the three areas of creative, technology and business, and how you create that symbiotic connection so that you can accelerate growth.
Interesting. So to kind of expand on that, we were also interested in what you had to say about companies' leadership. And I think that it kind of talks a little bit with this, you know, sitting there lost in translation. There's also this concept of balance, right? And how the best leaders really are able to orchestrate a harmonious balance between a lot of differing, you know, objectives and personalities and everything else. I think anyone who's really achieved a very senior executive level of success understands why it's so critical to master this skill, yet so few of us have that, or so few of us have been coached to get there. Why do you think that is? Like, what is holding us back, or what is even holding companies back and really helping to build the skill set within an organization?
It's a really great question, because what I find is it's very easy for CEOs or leadership teams to start talking strategy. It's really easy to start talking about what technology platform are we going to choose, or what's our new brand strategy, or how do we think about what our P&L is going to look like for that next 3 years. But what's a more uncomfortable conversation is, are we the right people to be leading this? Is that, you know, look around the room, look left, look right. Are we the right executive team? Do we have the capability and capacity to take the company where we want it to go? And that's a tougher conversation, because you might have to fire yourself. You might have to decide, you know what? You know, I was the right company to come in as the chief marketing officer, you know, for this period of growth, but given where we're trying to get to, you know, actually, I need to take a different role in the company, and we need a different set of capabilities. And that's a tougher conversation, but one that's absolutely necessary, but it's often avoided. And so that's why it's hard. You know, I talk about like team mini-me. You know, CEOs sometimes hire people who are like them. And so if a CEO is highly technical, they might hire more technically inclined people, but maybe might not hire or might not value the creative voice so much. And so that creates an imbalance. And if you don't have someone pointing it out, then often it's easy to just run away and talk strategy and run off and talk your P&L, and you miss a huge opportunity to have a big impact.
So just really quickly following up on that, outside of pointing it out, how do you convince leaders to listen to this, right? Like, it sometimes I find in organizations, there are a lot of people that are willing to speak up and maybe point things out, but the listening and the willingness to change is where I see it getting stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. I call that the insulation layer. And we probably all know executives who have surrounded themselves in this insulation layer, in the, I don't want to hear it, don't tell me, or if you tell me, I will act in a way that means you're never going to tell me anything ever again. And so, you know, those kind of leaders really do need help in understanding what that insulation layer creates for them. And then other leaders just might not have had their insulation layer pushed enough or tested enough. And so, you know, being able to test that with your leadership team and say, hey, there's some things I've noticed here that we really need to talk about. So that's a reason why it doesn't happen. And in terms of how do you have this conversation? Well, what you do is you say, let's talk about our strategy. Let's not talk about today's strategy or even next year's strategy. Let's leapfrog our strategy into the future and take a 3-year window or a 5-year window and say, where is it we want to be? And then what you have to do is you have to say, what customers, what industries, what channels, what countries are we going to be in 3 years' time? And then you say, okay, let's time travel our current leadership team to the future and say, who has managed a company that size, that scale, that complexity? Or is everyone going to be in the biggest jobs of their lives? And then if they are all going to be in the biggest jobs of their lives, I'm not saying you should fire everyone, but you should certainly be aware of it and then say, okay, who might it make sense for us to hire next? Who should be on our board of advisors? Who may we want to move to the side and bring someone else up? And by having that conversation, by talking strategy first, and then do we have the capability and capacity to get there, that helps open the door to the awareness that something needs to change.
Thank you.
Interesting. So Val, you speak in the book about the importance of putting the right person in the right job, but you're talking less about evaluating your employees in that regard and more about evaluating yourself, because quite often we find that the barriers to success are there because you're pursuing the wrong path or you're in the wrong role. So can you talk more about the process you outlined for defining and discovering that resonant career path for oneself?
Absolutely. I would love to click my fingers right now and have all the people who are miserable in their jobs be in their perfect job, right? Can you imagine? I mean, how many times do you have a conversation with a colleague or a peer, and after you get over the, yes, how are you? Yes, I'm fine. And then you get them to really tell you what's going on. And they go, oh my goodness, my job, or oh my goodness, my boss, or oh, this is so frustrating. And it's because they are not in their perfect job. And many times it's because, particularly people who are incredibly successful, they rapidly grow in their career. And sometimes their company grows alongside them. Sometimes it grows faster, sometimes it grows slower, sometimes they just end up in a role. And if you don't intentionally pay attention to, hey, what are the parts of my job that I absolutely love? If I was to, you know, in the book, I talk about this idea of going a walk down memory lane, where you literally go through every job you've ever been in and pick all your favorite parts and say, what was it you loved about that job? What about this job? And if you don't spend some time thinking that through, then you don't really know what it is that you truly love and what truly excites you. You know, I was talking to a chief technology officer earlier this week, and he's evaluating, you know, 2 job opportunities. And he said, I just don't know what to do. You know, both packages are amazing. I don't know how to compare. And I said, well, think through what are the factors that are important to you in what you do next, and have that, you know, just like you'd evaluate a software vendor, evaluate these jobs against set criteria. And so that's what you have to do in terms of thinking about what your perfect job is. And then you can evaluate and say, well, what's my job now? What things could I change? What things could I delegate? What things might I ask for more responsibilities for? Or is it time for you to go work for another company?
Interesting. So expanding on that, knowing what your area of expertise are so super important. How do you then position yourself in a place that you can be successful among all the other skill sets that you need around you, right? How do you have that trifecta? How do you become trilingual in a way that makes you successful? Because part of it is I might know what I'm good at, what I want, but it's a little bit of what do I need from others?
Yeah, and so I talk about this trilingual executive because I think everybody's heard the, hey, you've got to have a business focus. You've got to have a business lens. You know, as a marketer, I must promote the business side of things. Of course, yeah, you know, everybody kind of gets that and has varying degrees of success. But as a marketing expert, as a creative person, you have to also be able to speak the language of technology and understand technology. And so one of the things I encourage people to do is think about your proudest achievements, think about your accomplishment, and then now speak about it through the lens of technology. Speak about it through the lens of business. Speak about it through the lens of the creative goals you had. And if you break down your achievements in those three ways, then if you're talking to a technology leader and you've just launched a new brand campaign, sure, you're going to want to talk about some of the creative elements, but you can also focus on what are the new technology breakthroughs that you have implemented. Or if you're talking to your CFO, you can immediately start with return on investment, how it's changed your customer acquisition rates and how it's changed your impact on your profitability. And so being able to think through your achievements, not just in terms of what you've done, but how might it translate, is one way you become trilingual. And then the other way is you have to think through when are the times that there is power in getting a decision made. And you know, the easiest way to think about that is budget time. Like budget time, everyone fights for who's gonna get what share of the, you know, new financial year's commitments. And what you have to be able to do is talk about your projects or your initiatives or your strategies through the lens of, you know, the CFO is gonna be looking at it from a finance point of view, your marketing colleagues are gonna be looking at it through, well, what does this mean from a creative side? And the technology team is gonna be looking at it through, okay, does this fit with our platform development plan? How are we thinking about future technologies and strategies? And so you can use it to influence you to get the support you need for new budget, for new strategies, as well as help make decisions. So those are a couple of the ways that you can use that idea of speaking trilingual that will benefit.
So one subject you touched on that resonated strongly with me on a personal level is the importance of executive support and innovation, because I spent many years in innovation roles in the agency world. And time after time, I saw brands lose out on these game-changing opportunities to do first to market with new technologies. And it almost always mapped back to a lack of executive support at the highest level. Either the senior most executives on the brand side weren't interested, or more often than not, their teams weren't willing to go the extra mile to convince them or to take the risk. But you can't innovate successfully without executive support. It doesn't happen, and yet it's in such short supply. So how can you work effectively to change that within an organization?
Yeah, it's a really good insight, because there are so many brilliant ideas buried in companies that are lost because of the lack of executive support, especially right now. You know, the very best companies are taking their innovation sandbox ideas and rapidly accelerating them through their company. And that only works, like you say, if you've got executive support. So, you know, when I work with chief innovation officers or executives in charge of innovation labs, what I talk to them about is, first of all, you have to map your own impact in terms of where is your level of impact. And, you know, I use this influence bullseye, which is unusual, because in a bullseye, typically you want to aim for the very center of the target. And if you think about, you know, your influence plan right now, there are typically 3 to 5 executives who hold the purse strings, if you like, who hold, you know, the key to your success, be it budget support, be it your promotion, be it your credibility. So if you immediately think of who are those, you know, executives that are the strongest impact, and I call those power influencers. So your power influencers are the people at the center of the bullseye, but those are not the people you want to chase, which seems counterintuitive. What you want to do is you want to ask yourself, okay, let's say your head of technology is a key power influencer. What you want to do is you want to say, who are the people who influences your power influencer? Who are the people who talk in their ear? Who are the people who they rely on for preparing for a board meeting, or whose opinion they value? And I call those amplifiers, because they amplify positive and negative insights. And what you have to do is you have to evaluate your relationship with those amplifiers. And that's the kind of like way you exponentially get to impact those people in the center of the bullseye. So if you think power influencers are in the center of the bullseye, around the power influencers, that next concentric circle, are your amplifiers. Around the edges are all your power partners who you deal with day to day. They're your daily partners. But of course, you need to spend time with them. But it's the middle ring that the, not the center ring, but the one around the center ring, are the ones you want to spend your time and energy on. And I give you a toolkit that, you know, I use with lots of leaders that helps you evaluate, map, and then accelerate how you're seen by those amplifiers, which in turn influences those people who hold the purse strings. So many people say, well, Val, why don't I just go after the power influencers? It's far easier. Well, it's not, because you can't get on their calendar. They don't have time for you. They may or may not have other people trying to clamber for their time. Whereas your amplifiers give you a greater set of access and allow you to build a stronger relationship. And so if you evaluate your influence and you realize, hey, I'm lacking in these areas, you can actively go after that. And I'd say that's more important than coming up with your next crazy innovation idea, which will be futile as people find out, if no one's prepared to back you or influence you, agree with you once you present your pitch.
So does that, or how does that then tie into the ability for companies to sustain success, right? You talk about BlackBerry in your book, which was wildly successful. I can't name anyone who hasn't a BlackBerry. You know, every company was handing them away, right? A great way to stay connected with all your consumers at work and outside of work. But then everything started changing so quickly. And the moment that first Apple smartphone came out, boy, did this industry change. And BlackBerry couldn't keep up. And I think back to business school, and it talks about innovative companies, and they all have this hockey stick where they grow, and you can't just continue to grow because you start to go down, you need to take a jump. And it's almost hard to impossible for companies to do. So what do you think, you know, is it the people? Is it something else in innovation? Is it something else that companies need to do for them to really figure out how to avoid some of the crash and burn, you know, taking that success and continue to reinvent themselves?
Absolutely. And it's a great comparison to make in terms of, you know, why did BlackBerry go from the market share they did to less than 1% market share in like 4 years? How did, you know, companies that were incredibly successful break through and innovate? And, you know, the example I like to use is with Microsoft. So Microsoft created the Xbox, and there was so much fighting inside Microsoft to make Xbox a Windows-based platform. So to have Windows technology inside Xbox, and the innovators for Xbox went, no, we do not want to use a Windows platform. It's going to be a gaming platform. We can't use Windows. So there's a huge tension there. But Xbox team won and got to not use Windows. And they ended up creating a separate campus that was 3 miles down the road from the rest of Microsoft. They created different cultures. They created a lot of the things that were frustrating at Microsoft at the time. It's like, hey, we're going to do decisions differently. We're going to find new ways to work together. And so how can a company be successful and then continue, you know, creating more and more hockey sticks? You sometimes have to break everything that you currently do and try something different, you know. And then Xbox had its own roller coaster. You know, we had, you know, I was in my corporate days, I was on the Xbox leadership team when we had a $1 billion write-off because of hardware failures. So, you know, many of your listeners, you know, may have had an Xbox at the time. I'm sorry, it was awful. You know, you had the red ring of death because the machine had a red circle on it, and then it like literally bricked the whole machine, and you had to ship it back, and we had to ship you another. It was a disaster. And, you know, Steve Ballmer, the CEO at the time, you know, told us he was going to shut us down if we didn't find a way to innovate and do something different. And so, you know, this was, you know, one of the things I was part of, and I kind of talk about this in my second book, is we created an innovation lab before innovation labs really had a name, you know, because it was, you know, a few years ago. And we challenged everyone to say, how do we create what was called all access gaming. How do we move away from this shooting and racing and, you know, hardcore gaming device and broaden the appeal to a broader group of customers? And that's where the idea of Kinect came from. You know, at the time Wii was out, you know, people might remember, you know, Nintendo, you have a plastic stick with a wire and you play tennis. And if you could see my video now, I'm waving my hand, you know, because that's how I used to play tennis on the Wii. And we wanted to leapfrog that. So we created the Kinect camera that had voice control and you could like dance with your arms and it would pick up your movement. And that leapfrogged what Nintendo had done. And we broke a lot of rules when we created that innovation lab. You know, there's a whole case study in the book about all of the cultural rules we broke at Microsoft in order to let that happen. So for a company to radically change, they need to be okay with trying new things and failing and experimenting. And it requires a level of curiosity that some companies might need to practice how to do that.
So the ability for a company to innovate at the corporate level is very much tied to the ability for, you know, individual executives within the company to exert their influence to push that innovation. And so something that you wrote about at length in Thoughtfully Ruthless that I honed in on and thought was really interesting is the importance of being able to showcase your own achievements in order to be able to assert that kind of influence. Because to your point, your personal valuation impacts your company valuation. But for women in particular, that's an incredibly hard mindset to achieve because we're conditioned to be modest, to downplay our capabilities and our success. So for leaders in general, but for women in particular, what can you do to make that shift?
First, get over yourself. And I say that with love and kindness because, you know, I'm saying this as a humble British woman who was brought up to not talk about her achievements, to never talk about success, to never shout about what I've done. And, you know, honestly, when I moved from the UK to the US 15 years ago, I had the biggest shock of my life when I came over from the UK over here, because I was at Microsoft at the time. I'd always had a very high, fast, rapidly growing career. And I came over here and everyone kept telling me how awesome I was. And so I sat in my boss's office waiting for my performance review. And I was sat there waiting to be told I was promoted. And I got told I was average. And I got an average performance score and I got average bonus. And back then at Microsoft, you had a lifetime annual review score. So that's average score stuck with me for another 3 years until it was averaged out. And what I didn't realize, despite doing all these incredible things, is I got dinged because I was not talking about my achievements. And only the people who knew my work knew my work. And at Microsoft at the time, it was very important to manage up and manage across, and performance calibrations happened. And that was when I had the biggest shock of my life that what I did was not enough. And, you know, there are different cultural approaches to how you talk about your achievements that layer on top of the woman versus men ability to talk about your achievements. And so I kind of had this double whammy of, oh my goodness, I have to talk about my achievements if I'm going to be successful in this corporate culture. And so that's when I started to realize, and you know, I talk about this in my first book, that it's not enough to be brilliant. You have to be brilliant at demonstrating your brilliance. And if you are not brilliant at demonstrating your brilliance, you become a best kept secret. And other people who may talk about their brilliance will overtake you. And then there are these people that, of course, there's no one you're listening to, but who are listening to your podcast. But there are these people who might not be that brilliant, but are really good about talking up their achievements. And that, you know, that the concept of the empty suit, you know, who talk a good game, but then can't actually deliver. You know, that causes many people to retreat, to say, I don't want to be that person. So I'm not, you know, maybe it wasn't me. Maybe it was the team who create, you know, delivered these results. You know, well, I kind of did this, but can't really talk about the profit impact. And so we retreat more into our shell because we're worried about being too over the top and bragging. And so that's where I say, you just need to get over yourself and understand your impact and your achievements and talk about them as facts. And again, in the book, I kind of give you this toolkit of like, this is how you do it. Here's how you deconstruct your success. Here's how you identify your achievements. And, you know, I get many people to just sit in a quiet room for 2 hours and literally, you know, have your resume there or have your LinkedIn profile and take a walk down memory lane. Remember all the things that you have ever done in any company, in any initiative, in any project, and then apply the so what filter. It's like, you launched this project, so what? What was the impact on market share, profit, revenue? And then start to craft a story that, you know, frankly, many successful executives have never told in terms of, here's the impact I had. You know, I was working with this one executive and she was a CMO and she, you know, we had a number of conversations. And then about 3 weeks later, we're talking and she says, oh yeah, well, there was that time when I got this product on the Ellen show. And I'm like, hang on a minute. What did you just say? She said, oh, well, I got this product on the Ellen show and it resulted in, you know, a 30% increase in our sales. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me about that 6 weeks ago? She's like, well, I didn't think it was that good. So sometimes you need an external person to calibrate for you and go, wait, hold on a minute. What you achieved is amazing. And that's something that I think is different from many women to many men, is they need someone else to go, wait, hold on a minute. That's amazing. Talk about that. And then you kind of like, oh, that's good, is it? Oh, all right. Okay. Maybe I'll talk about it.
I think many of us that are listening to this podcast, me included, need an inner Val right in our ear all the time. Just to remind us of, you know, celebrate, always celebrate your achievements, right? And do it in a very thoughtful manner.
It's so true, because it's very easy to run from one thing to the next. And I bet your listeners right now could just take a minute, like with a pen and paper, and just think about the last 3 months and say, well, what is it you're really proud of? What is it you're really proud that you have achieved in the last 3 months? And you could do it while I'm talking now, and you could just write down three things. And then you could say, okay, now I've written down those three things. How do I translate that to profit, impact, revenue, customers, my community? Okay, and then you ask yourself, who have I told that story to? And this is when you go all, I don't want to tell that. Yeah, well, no, maybe I'm not going to talk about that one. And then you've got to ask yourself, why? Why are you holding back? Why are you not sharing your success with other people? Because you become a best kept secret. And in the book, I have this kind of like ladder where you can see how magnetic you are. And at the point where you might now all be cringing, going, yeah, right, okay, yeah, Val's doing that, but I don't really want to do that, and I'm not going to do that, then fine. But here's the consequence if you don't. Sure, you lose the impact you will have. But if you have a responsibility to hire, if you have a responsibility to get funding, if you have a responsibility to work with your investors or your board, the company loses out. Because I guarantee you, when you're hiring, people are Googling you. If you're a hiring manager, people are Googling and searching you and saying, okay, who's this person? What have they done? Where have they spoken? Where have they appeared? What does it say about them? What's your digital footprint look like? And people will gravitate towards, this is this magnetic executive, they will gravitate towards people of success. So if you've been quiet, if you aren't sharing your achievements, you're going to miss out on great hires, because they're going to gravitate towards people who are sharing those achievements.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I want to go back a little bit to something that you said earlier about moving ideas out of the sandbox, right? Uh-huh. I think we've all been, you talk about this in your book about quality versus quantity. And we've all been in situations where, you know, the well of ideas have potentially run dry, or they're just sitting in the well and they're not really going anywhere, like that sandbox. I think in this day and age, we talked just now a little bit about these last 3 months, right? Everything that has impacted us with COVID has really turned everything upside down. And it has taken some people or some companies further into a rut, and it has allowed some companies to find ways to get out of it. So I think it's really interesting to examine that a little bit. And I'm wondering what thoughts you have in addition to some of the things that we've talked about in terms of how to break some of those old habits, or how to look at, you know, ideas in changing and innovating in this new environment, which poses even more challenges, I think, than before.
It's a great point. And if you think about any company you're working with, any organization, any association, any community that you're running, you have a closing window that is closing. And in about 2 months, that window will be closed. And it will be closed to reinvention. Because right now, everybody who is successful is thinking about, how do I adapt? What can we do different in our company that might respond to the short term or might respond to the long term? And so if you're a company that has customers, how the customers are currently reacting, or how you, if you work through a partner ecosystem, how do your partners react? You have a chance to change everything right now. But that window is closing. In 3 months' time, it'll have gone away. But right now, the very best, most successful companies are going, okay, what can we do different? Okay, now's the chance for us to evaluate our technology platform. Now's the chance to evaluate our partner network or our retail footprint or how we communicate with our customers. And some companies are tinkering around the edges and saying, how are we going to skate by and survive? And some companies are completely resetting and saying, you know what, we can use this as a chance to, you know, we've always wanted to double down on our e-commerce strategy. So now let's look at, how do we treat our e-commerce strategy as our biggest store if we're a retail company? What would that look like? And, you know, I often, you know, I've been saying this for years and there's never been a chance to take this on more than right now, which is, what if you were to reinvent your company today? What if you took your company and you literally had a blank sheet of paper and you said, okay, our expertise is in X. How would we, if we had a blank sheet of paper, reinvent our company today? What would the blueprint look like? How would we go to market? What would our channel strategy look like? And then you have this blueprint and then you can say, okay, what might we reset today? What might we change? Because there's an opportunity to renegotiate. There's an opportunity to change. People are willing to listen to new ideas more, but that window will close in a few months.
Yeah, very interesting.
So if ever there were a time to hydrate your network, I assume now is the time. And that to me was one of the most important takeaways from the book. And I think from the last book as well. And I remember the first time I heard you talk about this was on stage, I think maybe a year ago at Digital Ascendant. You got up there and you asked, you were talking about the importance of networking and maintaining your network. And then you asked the room, stop and consider, is your network dehydrated? And you could see this look of sheer terror across almost every face in the room, because theoretically it should be the easiest thing, right? Nurturing those human relationships and, you know, staying connected to the people who can support you and elevate you and help you get to the next level. But more often than not, it ends up being not the easiest thing, but the hardest thing. So advice for our members on how to successfully hydrate their network?
Absolutely. So the concept of dehydration, you know, I have three young girls, 10 and 12, and, you know, they love those dehydrated sponges. I know you've seen your tiny little shrink wrap things that are like minuscule, and then you put a few drops of water on them and they turn into this giant dinosaur like creation. Well, I think of people's networks like that, you know, that if you don't tend to your networks, and people wince when I say networks because that implies networking, which implies uncomfortableness, which I'll talk about in a second. But if you don't tend to your networks, they get dehydrated. And then the other factor that comes in here is really successful people, if you think about how you have typically got most of your jobs, you get jobs because you know people who can hire you. And you often never apply for a job, never have to speak to a headhunter, and you get tapped on the shoulder a lot, up until about 5 years ago. And then all of a sudden, because you're getting promoted and you're getting promoted and you're getting promoted and you're getting bigger, bigger jobs. And then the people who are around to hire you kind of fall off, because you might be going faster than them. You might be overtaking them. And so what you have to do is not only tend to the people that are around you, you have to make sure that you know people who can hire you. And what I find is many really successful executives get to like VP and maybe, working for the CEO level. And then when they hit that level, they realize, they look around and look left and look right and go, I don't know anyone who can hire me anymore because I'm the most senior person in my network. And that's where you have to pay even more attention to building those relations so you can, like, not just hydrate your network and keep it active, but be active with people who can hire you. And so the concept of staying in touch, again, it's kind of like a reverse irony, because the more successful you are, you've got stuff to do. You've got work to do. You're working on really exciting things in the company. You don't have time to be like calling people you worked with 10 years ago and saying, hey, do you fancy a coffee? But that's exactly what you need to do. And, you know, I annoy a lot of people when I say this next thing, so I'm going to probably annoy lots of your listeners when I say this, which is, it's going to take you 6 months to catch up. It's going to take you 6 months to recover from not staying in touch. Because as you know, you're not going to all of a sudden click your fingers and then be able to, you know, build back relationships again. It's going to take you 6 months. So you can get away with not contacting anyone in your network for 6 months. But then you've got 6 months, it's going to take you to rebuild it. And so what I encourage people to do, you know, if you're now at the point where you're like, okay, all right, I get it. I've got to rehydrate my network now. What you do is, the fastest thing you can do is export and download all of your LinkedIn connections into a spreadsheet. And then what you can do is, because you'll be surprised where some of those people are that you used to work with. And the quickest way you do it is you go into LinkedIn, download it into a spreadsheet, and then you can go through and say, hey, who are people that I know? And then this is where you find out if you've like accepted too many LinkedIn connections of people you don't know, but that's fine. You go through it and you prioritize that list and say, who are people who I, you, three buckets. First bucket is people I want to reconnect with. Second bucket might be people who could introduce me to people I want to be connected with. So they might work at one of your desirable companies, and so you want an introduction. Or they might work on a board that you want to, you know, become an advisor at. Or they might be part of a community that you want an introduction to. So group one is people that you want to connect, reawaken the network with. The second one is people that could give you an introduction. And the third is everyone else.
So then what you do is you take the first bucket and you decide how many people that you're going to call a week. You might decide 5 or 10. And the reason I say call is because people do listen to their voicemail messages, and you will stand out from the 73 other messages that people get in their inboxes, and you want to do something different.
Interesting. So outside of hydrating your network, right? Another, I think, final question that we have for our listeners is really about coaches, right? And vetting a coach. We mentioned earlier, you know, that it's amazing how many people are pivoting in their careers and becoming coaches, but not all coaches help you in the same way, right? They all have different specialties. What are your thoughts around, you know, what lessons can people take away in terms of what should they be identifying in terms of how to vet the right coach for them?
Of course. The first thing you have to do is ask, why do you want an external expert? And so when someone says to me, you know, are you a coach? I say, no. And they're like, well, you are, you coach people. I'm like, sure, I coach people, I speak, I work with leaders, I advise, but I'm an expert. And my expertise is in innovation, high growth companies, and in leadership. And what you have to do is, when looking at anyone that you might want to hire externally, is you have to say, what's their expertise in? Because as you found out, like, anyone can call themselves a coach. You know, there's certifications out there that you can buy, that you can attend, but who's certifying the certifiers? And kind of coaching has become everything from life coaching to performance coaching to, you know, I'll tell you what color of the rainbow you are, because then that's going to help you be able to make decisions better. But you get a label and it doesn't actually have any impact on your business whatsoever. So what you have to do is, first of all, decide what expertise do you need? What expertise do you want to bring into your company or in your life? And then the best thing that you can do is ask for referrals. So ask people who have worked with an external expert and say, who do you know who's helped you, and how, you know, can you introduce me? And then let's say, you know, you don't have any introductions, so you're evaluating people kind of cold. You have to ask them for testimonials and say, well, what results have you created? What What impact have you had? Which companies have you worked with? And that should give you some filters to use so you can decide, you know, what's the return on investment of hiring an external expert?
Val, you know, it was such a pleasure talking to you today. I cannot even wait for all of our listeners to tune into this episode. You've given so much good advice on this podcast, also through your books. It's like an actionable plan, which really falls in line with what Embolden is about in terms of really investing in building your personal brand. And I feel like everything we really talked about today, whether it was for you or your impact in a company and how to choose companies that talk to you, it all kind of goes around that same element. And we're just so fortunate to have you as part of our network. So thank you so, so much for taking the time to speak with us today, for being so honest with us and being so open with everything that you shared. Thank you once again.
It is a pleasure to be here. One of my idols is a mystery person who's also from England, and his name's Banksy. And Banksy is a British street artist. He does graffiti, and he does graffiti that's memorable and that provokes. And so what I, as a lasting thought, I encourage all of your listeners to do is you can find me on social media, you know, find me on Instagram, and you'll find me sharing pictures of Banksy. My favorite latest one is a picture that he's done of a picture of a bathroom that has been invaded by rats. And what it shows is the rats kind of trashing the toilet paper, the mirror, there's mess everywhere. And the caption is, "My wife hates it when I work from home." So imagine the conversation starter that a picture like that brings to any conversation. So, you know, so many people are working from home right now. Lots of people are, you know, asking me, "Hey, Val, will you come and invigorate our video calls? Will you come and help us teach remotely? How do we make things more interesting and exciting?" So, you know, I just want to end by saying, you know, I really appreciate my fellow Brit Banksy for keep creating art that helps us have a conversation that, you know, talks about the reality of working from home, because it's kind of crazy. And I love that, you know, we got to meet through a in-person event, and now we get to, you know, share ideas and have a conversation digitally. So thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Val.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Mad Women Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the conversation with Val Wright as much as we did. If you'd like to learn more about Val and the strategies we discussed in this episode, we recommend picking up her books, Thoughtfully Ruthless and Rapid Growth Done Right, Lead, Influence, and Innovate for Success, both of which are available through Amazon, Amazon UK, Barnes & Noble, Porchlight, Waterstones, BAM, Books A Million, and Vroman's Bookstore. You can also visit valwrightconsulting.com to read a sample chapter and sign up for Val's newsletter. We have interviews with more inspiring women coming throughout July and August, and we hope you'll join us for our conversations with these luminaries. Until then, stay bold and brilliant, Mad.